Okay, welcome everybody. Welcome. Settle down. Settle down. Nice to see everybody. Welcome to the first session after lunch. So we've got a really interesting session on retirement incomes. So I'll begin by introducing our two speakers. We're joined by Hamish. Hamish is Global Head of Individual and Flow within Pacific Life Re's saving and retirement business. Based in the UK, he leads the company's global entry into the individual retirement income markets, as well as pensions risk transfer and savings new business flow propositions. Hamish joined Pacific Life Re in 2016 and was previously head of R&D and longevity business development. With almost 30 years in the financial services industry, Hamish has significant experience spanning life and pensions across UK, Japan and Australia in a variety of direct consultancy and reinsurance positions. Welcome, Hamish.
Thank you.
And also Helena Hayes. Helena serves as AVP Global Individual Retirement Income at Pacific Life Re. Based in Sydney, she leads the company's entry into the Australian longevity market, as well as supporting development of PLRE's retirement income proposition globally. She joined the Australian team in 2019 as a research and development AVP following a five-year tenure in London, where she focused on pricing longevity and swap transactions. Her experience and dedication to the global retirement income market drives her commitment to fostering knowledge exchange across different markets. Helena is passionate about supporting the development of a retirement market in Australia, where individuals receive comprehensive support throughout both the accumulation and decumulation phases of retirement. So welcome, Hamish and Helena. I'll pass over to you.
Thank you very much. We're going to do a wee bit of sharing the presentation back and forth, so hope you don't get dizzy as we twirl on the stage. As well as our job titles, we're doing a separate role today. So Helena is our millennial rep, and I'm our Gen X rep, slap bang in the middle of Gen X, in fact. So today. Helena's going to cover the introduction, and then I'm going to take a step back and cover the different markets that we're covering today, the UK, USA, and Australia. And then Helena will take you through the research framework that we've used and the start of the key results, and then I'll bring it back to some sort of real examples globally, and then we'll wrap up there and hopefully leave plenty of time for questions. So... first handover.
I'll see how this goes. Thank you, and thanks everyone for joining us. Right. Excellent. So what were we trying to achieve through this investigation? So we paired up with Harvard Undergraduate College Consultancy Group with three main aims in this investigation. So the first thing we wanted to do was explore the disconnect between the perception and the value of lifetime guaranteed annuity products. So we understand for most individuals, the inclusion of a guaranteed lifetime income product would actually add a lot of value. And most individuals do actually want to see guaranteed lifetime income within their kind of retirement ecosystem. However, they remain incredibly unpopular across the globe, except obviously in locations where they are compulsory. So the first thing we wanted to do was understand the disconnect between that perception, but also the value that they can offer. The second thing that we wanted to do then was map that sentiment around guaranteed retirement income products across the globe in three of the key markets that we're mostly interested in. So that was the US, the UK, and Australia. And then from there, what we wanted to do was bring it all together into some forward-looking solutions as well. So that was kind of the overall aim of what we're trying to do here. So then going from there, before we dive into some more of like the market background and the research, we want to give you a sneak preview of what our key findings were. So across the globe, what we found was there was like a real three powerful themes that came through in all of the research that we saw. So we saw that people around the globe were falling into one of three categories. So either individuals were failing to prioritize their retirement, and that could be because either they don't know that they should be prioritizing it, or they simply don't have the cash today to prioritize, but they know they should. There was the group of people who fell into the lack of trust. So for those individuals, there's just a general caution towards the insurance industry. And also unknown brands as well. And then also on top of that, there's a reluctance to engage with like digital tools. But that's something we'll talk about in a bit more detail. And then there was the final group where they know they should be prioritizing it. They do trust the system for the most part, but they just don't know where to start. And for those individuals, it can be mostly analysis paralysis, so just like too many options. Or for a lot of people, it's just like a fear of facing reality. People don't want to think about their retirement and think about that later stage. So just not doing anything is the easier option. Second handover.
Okay, so I'm going to take you into the three markets that we've looked at and why we have. So it's good that I'm here and it's Australia. So as we probably know, it's Australia's world leading in terms of saving for retirement. In the plenary this morning, I think it was number five or six overall, and a lot of that was to do with the kind of decumulation phase, but certainly world leading on the accumulation. In the UK, we've got a really long and rich history of DB pensions, and there has been historic compulsory annuitisation that's no longer compulsory from 2015, and DC savings are starting to grow. And then in the US, there's complex rules, but there's also a rich history of retirement savings and tax advantage systems. So we've got some diverse retirement systems. We've got some mature financial markets. All countries are experiencing demographic pressure. And also, there were good countries, they're English-speaking and data-rich. There's probably another reason why we choose these three, because we operate in the markets as well. They're close to us. There's probably a fourth market that could have been included, which is the Netherlands, and it's probably another one of these world-leading with a rich history of DB, and the Netherlands are actually about to switch most of their historic DB into DC. That's probably a subject for another day to talk through, but a really interesting dynamic going on there. So I'll just tell you a wee bit about each market. So I've got kind of all on the one page here some of the key features, but I'll break it down into simple steps. First thing to probably look at here is the chart on the right showing two different things. One is what proportion of assets are in defined contribution and what are in defined benefit. I'll just quickly define these. I think probably everyone in the room should know, but defined contribution is you save up into, you know, a pot of money, like a savings, and then you're left really to work out how you spend that. Whereas defined benefit, you accrue a promise of a retirement income, usually through an accrual each year. So when you get to retirement, you might have 50% of your final salary as a guaranteed pension for life. As you can see, Australia was really the first to jump from DB into DC. And as you know, that's grown now substantially. So most of the Australian is in DC. The UK was probably about 20 years behind Australia. It's now predominantly very much DC for new accrual, but there's still quite a rump of accrued DB in the UK. And that's coming to the pension risk transfer market in the UK and fueling that. And then the US is a bit in between. And then the other, the dotted line on the chart shows the percentage of retirement assets relative to GDP. And again, you can see Australia's leading that. So even though there's that whole rump of DB in the UK, Australia's kind of got the most relative to GDP. The other interesting fact here is the lifetime income take-up. So there's roughly, in the last year, there was about 15% of DC savers in the UK actually bought a guaranteed lifetime income product, very much lower in both Australia and the US. And we'll maybe delve in a bit more into these reasons as we go through the results. The other is around the interaction between state benefits. The retirement age or the state pension age is very similar between each country. It's actually going to go up to 68 and about 2038 in the UK. But one of the key differences is both the UK and the US are not means tested. There is an element of interaction with wealth as you kind of, in the UK, you accrue national insurance credits for every year you work and you pay more national insurance the more income you earn. But once you come to state pension age, you get that pension, no matter how wealthy you are. But as you know, in Australia, it's means tested, and that can lead to different behaviours in how you interact with the rules around the assets and the income and means testing, and can can either lead to more annuitization or less annuitization, depending on the interaction between that. Another big difference in the market, if most Australians will know here, there's the compulsory employer superannuation guarantee contributions, started back in 1993, moving to 12% from the 1st of July. In the UK, we introduced auto-enrolment, kind of phased in between 2012 and 2018, but we're now all in auto-enrolment. So you're automatically, as it says, automatically enrolled into pension scheme. One of the key differences here is the employee pays 5% and the employer has to pay 3%. There are more generous schemes that match employer, etc. But what you see in the UK, actually, unfortunately, is that people do opt out, especially with the cost of living crisis over the last few years. We might see like 10-15% of people opt out, which is, it's kind of like an irrational decision because you're losing out on your employer contributions. But people need the money, and so they are doing it. So a compulsory employer system certainly works better. And in the US, it depends by state. And then on the way in, it's taxed in Australia, you get tax relief in the other. And then one key difference is in Australia, you're tax-free on the way out as you take your money. In the UK and the US, you are taxed, although in the UK you still have a 25% tax-free, which is a benefit. There aren't necessarily any tax incentives, but there are things that happen in government policy that can change behaviour. So currently in the UK, if you die, your lifetime savings, if you die under the age of 75, they go tax-free to your estate. If you die over 75, the money goes to your state and then it's taxed at their marginal rate of income tax when they withdraw the income. In 2027, they're actually putting the death benefits and pensions into the inheritance tax regime, which we have in the UK. And so the government were just thinking about that, about raising money for the tax system. They weren't thinking about annuitization, etc. But this could lead to an even further take-up of annuitization in the UK, because one of the things when you buy an annuity, you're kind of giving up your death benefits. Well, if your death benefits are going to get taxed at potentially 70%, there's more incentive to put them into an annuity. So that's all in the markets. Pass back to Alina to go through the research.
All right. So I'm going to take the next few sections. So we're firstly going to cover off the research framework. So in terms of the approach for this research, we had two key stages. So the first bit was a market deep dive. So that was more the quantitative analysis around the uptake of guaranteed retirement income products. And we wanted to look at the industry trends across the three different markets. We also wanted to look at the kind of ecosystem of public policy that surrounded retirement income in each of the locations. We looked at the regulation as well, and then did a deep dive into the various different types of products that are available. And then the second bit that was spearheaded by Harvard undergraduate consultancy groups, so they took the lead on this bit. This was the focus groups. And this is the really interesting bit for us, because while we can do all of the kind of analysis of the stuff that's written down and the stuff that anyone can Google, this is the bit where you're really getting under the hood and understanding the sentiment around these products in the different locations. So there we wanted to really get the qualitative insights and understand the emotional drivers for why people were making certain decisions. This slide here talks to the kind of framework that was set up around how the focus groups were set up. So the Harvard Consultancy Group, they essentially followed like a traditional focus group selection process, whereby they ensure that they had the correct sample selection to cover the entire working age population of the three countries that we were working with. So that included making sure that we had a broad spectrum of people within the various age ranges, geography like around the various countries, income, household size, different career stages, and then making sure you had the correct apportionment of different genders as well. And what was important through these focus groups as well, obviously, was to make sure there were no dominant voices and to make sure that you were getting feedback from everybody, and it was done in a very kind of careful and thoughtful way, and people knew that what they were sharing was going to be kept safe as well. So that was important. The other thing I'll call out about the focus groups as well that I found interesting was when we came together to put the question set, we wanted to keep them as consistent as possible, so we were able to compare across the results we were getting. But then the other thing on top of that was we needed to make sure that we were tweaking the questions for the various countries that we were looking at as well, because some questions in the UK just did not make sense in Australia. So that was something that we kind of carefully put together. Right. So now we're on to the exciting bit. This is the results. So we're back here to the three themes that we introduced at the start. And you'll also see now that our representatives are back on screen again. What we noticed in the Australian market in particular was that each of the generations fit neatly into these three buckets. So to bring it to life, I'm representing millennials and younger today. And for people like me in Australia, retirement just generally is not a priority. So we're just assuming that superannuation is going to be there for us and we're just not thinking about it, or we just don't have the financial freedom to think about it and make it a priority. For people like Hamish in Gen X, so that's anyone 44 or above, there's just a general lack of trust in the system. So that's caution towards the overall insurance system and a reluctance to rely on information that's being provided by insurance companies in general. And then finally, we didn't have a boomer representative, so we chose someone that hopefully everyone in the room is aware of. We chose Angus Young, ACDC, to represent the boomer generation. We're not necessarily saying he doesn't know where to start, but we think that we know from our research that in general, boomers don't know where to start. There's a bit of analysis paralysis, too many options available, and just that fear of facing reality there. So then moving on, we wanted to explore, well, how does this actually translate into observable effects? So for people like me in Gen Y and Gen Z, generally what we saw come through in the focus group was that there was a lack of confidence in government pensions. So a lot of people spoke about going, there's a government pension there now, but we're not sure how long that's going to last for. But on the flip side, and maybe on a positive note, a lot of people were confident that their superannuation savings would be adequate for them in retirement. So there's a huge amount of trust in the overall superannuation system. That then got interesting when we jumped down into the next generation, Gen X, that Hamish is representing, because most people in that generation were worried that they would outlive their superannuation savings and they didn't trust what was there. So it seemed as though when we were moving towards the older generations that they didn't think that it was going to be adequate. Now, obviously, that's going to be partially driven by the proportion of their savings that they were accumulating throughout their working lifetime. But also it could be driven by the fact that as people are nearing their retirement, they might be looking a bit more closely at it and observing that what they're saving is not adequate. The other positive thing that came through in the focus groups was that people did genuinely want guaranteed lifetime income products, but they felt they were too good to be true. They didn't think that what we were saying they could have was possible. So that kind of comes back to the lack of trust. And then mirrored on top of that, what we saw come through was that people in Australia really wanted real life stories. So I think we talk often about annuities not passing the barbecue test in Australia. If you were to talk to your friend down the road at a barbecue, they wouldn't know what an annuity is. So what people really want to see in Australia is your neighbour, your friend talking about annuities and understanding what they are and demonstrating that they actually do work for the everyday person. And then on to Angus Young's generation, the boomers. There was just a general distrust of advice, and in particular free advice, and concerns about the qualifications of advisors. And I think that's obvious in the Australian market, where the recent history that we've had, you can understand why there would be that lack of trust around financial advice here. But that seemed to come through a lot more strongly in Australia compared to the other locations that we looked at. So then moving on to the solutions, which is why we're all here. We again looked at these specifically for Australia first, and then we zoomed out after that. But this probably will come as no surprise to anyone in this room. For Gen Y and Gen Z, the generation I'm representing, early engagement is really, really key. So getting in there early at times that it's not when somebody needs to make a financial decision around their retirement that you should be talking to them about these products. It's well in advance of that, and we should be warming people up to these concepts and ideas as you're working through your retirement life. And Hamish is going to show a slide later that talks about your retirement journey starting on day one of employment. And that's really how we should be thinking about this problem. Then for Generation X, the lack of trust generation, it's really just about providing unbiased information. What we noticed here was that in Australia, again, there's just this overall lack of trust in the financial services. And it's something that we really need to be cognizant of as we work through this this retirement problem as well. So being conscious of offering advice in an unbiased manner is key here as well. And then finally, for the boomers, the key here is wanting to be provided with options in a way that's digestible and not overwhelming individuals. And there's a stat here in blue. Studies have shown that tools with fewer options improve decision-making efficiency by 32%. And I think what we're seeing through a lot of the products that are coming through in Australia right now is there's just a whole host of options being put in front of people. And we're forgetting that there's an individual at the end of the day who needs to understand the product that's being put in front of them and needs to have that confidence to click yes on the product. So not putting all of these things in front of people, but actually slimming down those options will really improve people's decision-making process. And then the final thing that comes through both Gen X and boomers is that real life stories, which comes through very clearly in Australia. So this is my last slide on this section. In this slide, what we're doing here is we're zooming back out again and we're comparing the solutions across the globe. And as you could probably guess, what we observed is that one size does not fit all in terms of solutions across the globe. So in terms of digital tools, yes, they were useful across all of the countries that we looked at, the UK, the US and Australia. But as we've mentioned a few times, what we noticed is in Australia, people would value uniquely the real life stories to enhance those tools. So not just thinking about this as show me what my drawdown will look like and various options. They want to see a real person at the end of the day and how that's coming through. And they want to see themselves in the tools that they're being shown. Brand perception, I thought, was a really interesting one. So brand perception played a much bigger role for people in the UK compared to the US and Australia. So we think that's because of the history of DB and then DC pensions in the UK. And the way you accumulate your pension in the UK is actually through your insurer. So having a brand that you recognise in the UK seemed to be much more important than here in Australia. Then on to advice. So what we found is in Australia, financial advice, particularly around retirement, is really viewed with caution. So that theme that we've spoken about before, people aren't really sure, especially if they're seeing free advice, they're really cautious of this. And this contrasts with the UK and the US, where advice seems to be much more widely adopted. And Hamish is going to talk through a slide shortly, which talks about some of the free advice options that are available in the UK that people are really taking up. So there's definitely a difference there between the markets. And then finally, on to default options, which we understand, we know is quite a hot topic in Australia at the moment. And based on what we've seen, we can see that the default option can play a role across all of the markets that we were looking at in both the accumulation phase and in the decumulation phase. One thing that we've noticed is in the US, they're using default guaranteed retirement income options within the accumulation phase, so defaulting people into those, and we see those as being really neat options. So certainly we need to be looking at default options, and they can play an important role in each of the markets in a different way. And I'm going to pass over to Hamish to talk us through some case studies.
Thank you. Thanks, Helena. So this is a slide from Pacific Life that they use to engage the intermediaries looking after the super funds in the US. I was just talking through that retirement journey and the different stages. And so the key to this is getting that awareness and right at day one, knowing what the options, tools are available, etc. And then throughout the accumulation phase, continue with the education. Don't wait till retirement for the education. Get the education going through the phases, and then gradually introduce them to the resources as they head towards retirement. And then finally, give them the tools to use to understand their own retirement needs and make their choices and what products and plans are available. So it's a 40-year journey building up that education. Obviously, you can't go back in time and, you know, educate people from the start, but this is, you know, looking forward into the future. We should be educating people right now at a younger age. So that's one in the US. The other one is in default options. So they actually changed the regulations in the US to allow a default option into a guaranteed retirement income product. They put lots of guardrails around it, statements, etc. But it's starting to, obviously, defaults do more than nudge. People need to opt out of them, and it's interesting to see that the US were prepared to actually regulate to improve that. And then my final one, with quite a lot in it, is what's going on in the UK. The UK is by no means perfect in this, but there are lots of help and initiatives. So Money Helper and PensionWise are both government-backed initiatives. Money Helper kind of brings all the information around retirement together. And you can actually do live guaranteed retirement income annuity quotes through that website, linking into all the providers' websites. They're actually all health underwritten in the UK as well, so you can go through your whole health underwriting on this Money Helper website. PensionWise is more than just information. You can actually get a free session to get some guidance from an individual. They won't give you advice, but they'll lay out all your options and let you make the choices. You get wake-up packs. I hinted I was at the middle of Generation X, so I've had my wake-up packs telling me to get Mac together, to engage, potentially go and see an advisor. Shopping around is important. So again, it's a functioning guaranteed income market, but what is mandatory is for insurers to let their clients know that there are other options out there in the market. They should go and look to see if there's a better rate there, and they have to do that. And then finally, assessment tools are coming more and more into it. So the insurers are building, they're developing. And by the way, when I say insurers basically run the workplace super funds as well. There's generally not a separation between the superannuation fund and insurer in the UK. They're kind of together. And I was playing around with one of the tools yesterday on my own workplace pension. It was good, but it wasn't perfect. It missed out key information. It treated an annuity or drawdown as a one or other rather than a blend. Didn't allow me to enter my spouse's pension, which is kind of going to keep me going in retirement, I hope. But they're improving, and I think more and more the talk is they'll start making recommendations. And in the UK, the split between advice and guidance, the guidance is pushing the barrier, and so it'll be people like you do this, that sort of thing, and then you'll be able to click through and actually buy the product. So I'll stop there, just kind of sum up. As Helena's covered, there's three main themes are the prioritisation at the younger ages, the lack of trust at around about my ages, and basically when people are actually in it, they don't really know where to start. And then we've got the solutions. Really, really key one is this early engagement. Real-life stories is so important for Australians. And then the improved access to financial advice, and maybe taking lessons from the UK there, push the boundaries of the guidance into advice. So I'll stop there for questions.
Well, thank you, guys. Very interesting to compare the different regions there. We have got some questions coming through. We've got about 7 minutes left. So please do type your questions into the app, or if you prefer the old school, you can use the mic there in the middle of the room. So first of all, here's an interesting question. How did the US, the land of the free, I think there's irony in that, the land of the free, manage to introduce a default retirement income product into their system? And what can the Australian system take away? Any thoughts on that?
So I think there was a general move from the insurers to really push hard for this. And I think I don't quite fully know how they managed to do this, but I think the fact that they've put so much safeguards around it, it's almost like, okay, this is happening. We actually want to control it. So let's legislate and make sure there's all the safeguards, the annual statements, all that, rather than it kind of happening in a haphazard way. That would be my kind of main rationale behind it.
I think maybe just one additional piece of context there is that it's mostly coming through in the like institutional space, where you have the fund managers, and then you also have the plan sponsors, which would be the like the employers putting together those like the rules around the default option. So it would be your employer, your plan sponsor deciding that default option is the best thing for that group of individuals as well. So while it is legislated that they are permitted to do it, it would still be a decision that's made at a much kind of lower, like a smaller level.
Okay, thank you. Another question, which is, Australians have a very strong nest egg mentality when it comes to superannuation. Have you observed any products in other markets that allow customers to build up to annuity purchase over time within their super? So I think the focus is more on annuity purchase rather than the nest egg. Any products from other markets?
So the UK has got the history of compulsory annuitization, and so basically your accumulation fund about 10 years before retirement would not, you know, your kind of default investment options would naturally start investing proportionally into the assets that would back an annuity. So that's kind of where we were in 2015. When freedoms came in, the default options didn't change. So people didn't have to buy an annuity, but for several years, they were still defaulting to buying an annuity, which was the wrong thing. This wake-up call that I've talked about is now about trying to actually, are you going to do that? And what are the tools to support that? But one of the other things in the UK, there's almost still a framing that it's an income rather than a nest egg. So when I get my annual statement, it'll give me my fund value, but it'll also say this would equate to an income of such. As I said, that's not perfect because it's assuming it's one or the other, but you can maybe portion it. So it's kind of, it's almost in the psyche to do this. I mean, one of the key things about buying an annuity, as I mentioned at the start, is when you don't have a death benefit or a withdrawal benefit in it, you are benefiting from mortality pooling. Easy for us to say as actuaries, etc. But frame it in a different way. You can enhance your income by X percent by going in this because you're sharing with others. So it's, I do get that education piece needs to come, and it needs to be a kind of step change in this. And personally, my pension savings are for my retirement. There's too many people who think their pension savings are for handing to the next generation, and it's just changing that mindset. That's not to say I won't treat my kids now and again, but...
Glad to that. Yeah, maybe I'll just quickly add the experience that we've seen in the US market as well. So specifically a product structure that is becoming more and more popular there is a product that you would begin purchasing at like age 50 or 55, depending on the rules they put in place. And you slowly purchase chunks of an annuity over time, and there's a couple of benefits with this product. You benefit from like the dollar cost averaging. So it means you don't have to purchase an annuity on a specific day and taking that risk of where the markets will be at. And then the other benefit is the cognitive piece that we were talking about earlier, where you're just slowly warming people up to the idea of purchasing an annuity. And the benefit of these products as well is that they actually stay like fully liquid until that point that you convert into your drawdown or into retirement until they become like an annuity. So you can always pull them out with like a market value adjustment at any point in time. So we're really seeing those products in the US become more and more popular.
Okay, thank you. Well, let's dig into the lack of trust a little bit more. There's a question here. So lack of trust in Australia comes from a history of corporate malfeasance and failures. Think Capita, National Mutual, etc. Annuities require you to pay a lump sum and expect payments back to you over a long time from a company that may not be around in the future. Any solutions to this? Are government guarantees required? Who'd like to take that?
So, again, it's like, they're specifics to countries, and you've given the examples in Australia. In the UK, there are a certain element of guarantees for the financial services guarantee. It wouldn't guarantee your whole annuity. But there is generally a trust in the insurers. They have been around a long time in the UK. They're well backed. They've got the capital behind them. So I don't actually have the solution other than potentially if the government are really, really want this to happen, they need to pull all the levers they can. So it's potentially a government guarantee is required.
Okay, thank you. Question on communication strategy. So super funds tend to be working, obviously, on this. Your research seems to suggest funds need four at least very different strategies, depending on current age cohort or time to retirement. Is that correct? We need at least four plus very different strategies.
Yeah, I think the way I think about this is less about four separate strategies and more just a long-term strategy of how do you communicate with the individual from the first day of their retirement all the way through to the point that they hit retirement. So not thinking about it in chunks, but more how are you warming the individual up to this money is not their nest egg, it is going to be their income in retirement. So it's more like a long-term strategy that spans the individual's entire working life.
Okay, thank you. What about key lessons from the UK? So the removal of compulsory annuitization, how did the UK address that material drop-off in the take-up rate of annuities?
So at first they didn't. When it happened, everyone in the UK looked to Australia and went, right, what have you got? What are you guys doing to help manage drawdown? And then we kind of then look back into ourselves. There was so much going on in the industry at that point as well. And then, as well as the falling off a cliff of annuities of freedoms, the interest rate environment was really low up until about 2022, 2023. But what we're seeing now is with the rising interest rates in the UK, well, it's globally, but particularly in the UK, we've seen the rising interest rates. Annuities suddenly become starting to look good value. We've actually got, although we're way behind Australia, we've actually got a lot of money coming now into DC that will only grow. So we've got more money coming in, we've got better rates, we've got kind of a history behind it. And the tools and the engagement are getting there, that it's not drawdown or annuity, it's kind of a blend of solutions. Put 20% into the guaranteed lifetime income and use your other 80% to perhaps take a bit more riskier assets or higher expected returning assets. And so it's been a slow evolution, but we're getting there. And what we're actually seeing is advisors are genuinely now advising people to buy that guaranteed retirement income for the right reasons, for the higher expected return and the kind of safety it provides.
Interesting. So that economic piece is important. Remember studying pensions in the UK when bond yields were 9%, you know, and annuities were great, you know.
Yeah.
I had another question, actually. Still time for... we've got a couple more coming in. I'll ask one, actually, from this morning. Peter Chun was saying about, you know, Unisuper. They've got very good, in one of the plenary sessions, very good engagement in the members, and the Unisuper members, I guess, very educated. How do we sort of get over the education and the information problem with, you know, other funds where you might have, you know, different socioeconomic groups, different occupation profiles, may not be as educated as lecturers and teachers and those sort of things? How do we get across that, you know, that barrier, if you like?
I think it's key, as you mentioned there, is understanding who's in your funds and a demographic around that. So UniSuper, more engaged, more highly educated. And so you have to tailor the education piece for the different types of funds. I think that would be absolutely key to me. You should do something. So first thing is do something rather than nothing. Don't bamboozle. Keep it nice and simple where it needs to be simple, and then slowly start growing that up. As we kind of said, okay, you can't go and fix the past just now, so you need to sort of engage people and start that now. But also at the same time, start building up for the younger generation. I live in Scotland. My primary school children, they get financial education in schools. The banks engage with the schools, go in and do sessions with them. That's starting at a really, really young age. And then the industry can start taking over from there. So it's kind of a two thing. One, what can you do to fix it right now? Because you haven't done it in the past, but actually get in early where you can. And in fact, you'll find that hopefully there's less of this socioeconomic divergence in education if you build up from a younger age. And maybe I'm being idealistic here, but if you at least you can try and do this.
So, one piece to add to that as well is that, like, overall, the way we're thinking about this is that it certainly is a customer confidence, education, understanding problem, not a product problem at all. I don't think we need to be sitting in rooms creating more and more products because we don't think that's the problem. But I do think there is a role to play in peeling the products back and making them more simple. Like, what is more simple than saying, hand over this amount of money and you receive this amount of money for the rest of your life? And it's all the bells and whistles on top of these products and making them more and more complex that is making this a real challenge when it comes to trying to communicate them. So not a product problem, we don't think, but is there a role to play in making them more simple?
We do research on retirement income products at the University of New South Wales. And when we do focus groups, the consumers usually want it all. They want a death benefit. They want a guarantee period. They want flexibility. And so when you ask them, they want it all. It's like Christmas, but then it becomes more complex. So how do you solve that?
Yeah, the way we tend to think about that is trying to demonstrate, okay, you can have all of the options, but if you give up the withdrawal benefit or if you give up the death benefit, you get a real meaningful uplift in that day one income that you get. And also on top of that, not annuitizing 100%, so you maintain the flexibility and you maintain the withdrawal benefit and the death benefit within the pool of money that you're not annuitizing.
But
that's kind of the general principle.
Well, we as in this room and researchers, we talk about longevity risk, and more, the average Australian, I don't know, was they worry about longevity risk. They worry about buying the product and dying and losing all the money. And then if you take that guaranteed period away, and you say, of course, it gives a better payout, but it doesn't calm down that concern that they just paid. And they lose the endowment, what they just paid for it. And so
I do get that is the real issue. And that's something about the education and the building up that we need to think about. And we don't want to force energy down that route.
Well, we don't ask car producers to educate people about car engineering so they can buy the car. So it's a bit hard to push it back to, I mean, we have very few people come back to university in their 50s to learn about financial management. I would love to, but this pushing back the education piece is like, how?
that is a challenge, but we can, I don't think we should just walk away and say we can't do it. I think we should pick up the challenge and think, how do we do it?
It's very difficult, and we're just getting to the really interesting discussions, but we're out of time. So thank you so much for all the questions. Thank you to our presenters, Hamish and Helena.